Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Japanese Studies. I'm one of your co-hosts, Sami Siddiqui. Today, I'm speaking to Dr. Torsten Weber about his new book, Embracing Asia in China and Japan, Asianism Discourse and the Contest for Hegemony, published by Palgrave in 2018. Dr. Weber is a historian of modern East Asia at the German Institute for Japanese Studies. Welcome to New Books in Japanese Studies, Dr. Weber. Okay, so our first question is always biographical. Could you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself? Where did you grow up and how did you become interested in East Asian history?
Thank you for having me. I spent the first about 24 years of my life living in and near Mainz, a city at the Rhine River in western Germany, not too far from Frankfurt. In my youth, I had very little contact with East Asia, actually almost nothing. But curiously, my childhood dentist was Mr. Fukazawa from Japan. I never asked him where exactly he was from in Japan, and I do regret this to this day, to be honest. I recently learned that he has retired, so I guess I missed my chance to find out more about Fukazawa Sensei. As a student, I was always interested in history, and history seemed therefore a natural choice when I started my undergraduate studies at Mainz University. But there were no courses in East Asian history at my university, so I just focused on methods, theories, and European history. It was at the history department in Mainz that I saw a notice at the seminar's notice board, at the time a physical notice board, actually not a virtual one, which advertised a scholarship to study abroad in China. It's quite a long story how I ended up there, but I did eventually go to China and spent 2 years studying Chinese at Fudan University in Shanghai. After that time, I never went back to continue my original studies at Mainz University, but first did my MA in Chinese studies at SOAS in London, and later a PhD in Japanese studies at Heidelberg University.
Great, thank you. That's interesting. I didn't know all of this, so it's always great to hear how people got into their research areas. Now, could you tell us about the genesis of this project? What made you want to write Embracing Asia?
Yeah, actually, there's a quite specific starting point. One of the first texts in my PhD program was Takeuchi Yoshimi's What is Asianism? Ajya Shugito wa Nanika. I had to read this in the Japanese original, which was really, really tough at the time, and I only managed to read it thanks to the help of one of my senpai. I was fascinated with the depth of the analysis and also the engagement with Asianism as Ajya Shugi or Dai Ajya Shugi by Takeuchi. And after reading the text, however, I was not really sure whether Asianism had actually existed as an ism in Japan and in Japanese, in the Japanese language, because the most explicit examples Takeuchi gives are Sun Yat-sen's Greater Asianism lecture and writings by the Chinese communist Li Jiachao. So I asked myself, what about Japan? Was Asianism in the end something Chinese or Chinese invention? What did this new ism mean to the Japanese when it emerged? All these questions later actually became research questions for my book. And a second important point is that Takeuchi, who was a Japanese sinologist, was greatly concerned with China. So in my understanding, at least, he always thought Japan through the lens of China, and he was very interested in Japanese-Chinese interactions. This also greatly influenced my own view of Asianism and actually of my whole academic studies. And to me, then, Asianism cannot and could not be thought as Japanese Asianism, as many people had done so far, but Asianism as transnational discourse, in particular Japanese-Chinese transnational discourse.
So now, could you explain what you mean by the title? In doing so, could you tell us about the focus and the central argument of the book?
Yes, Embracing Asia is, in fact, not a reference to John Dowell's Embracing Defeat, which is very famous and people ask me about it. But it's actually a term that Ari Hotta, another scholar of Asianism, had used in her work. And I must have read this very early on in my research. And then apparently I had forgotten about it. But I must have remembered it subconsciously and only later found the reference to her use of the term again. Embracing Asia for me means to approach, deal, accept Asia in a way that looks friendly or can be friendly, but can also be forceful, almost like strangling Asia and, as Hotta herself writes, strangling Japan itself. More generally, I was also thinking of more and more people becoming willing to take Asia and Asianism as concepts seriously and to use it, and especially to use it positively. So the basic argument then for my book is that during the time frame that I studied, Asianism and Asia changed from a foreign referential, foreign imposed, peripheral and mostly negative and denied or largely ignored concept to one that was self-referential, self-defined, central and widely affirmed and in fact embraced. Through Asianism, I argue Asia emerged as a central geographical, cultural, racial, and political category in both Chinese and Japanese published discourse.
That's great. That perfectly sums up the argument and the central topic of the book. Thank you. Now, Asianism is a complex political and intellectual movement, and you have a really detailed, conceptually sophisticated exploration of Pan-Asianism in your first two chapters. Could you talk about the heterogeneity of the movement across time, space, and ideological spectrum? Could you also tell us what you think is the best way for us to think about Pan-Asianism?
Yeah, I actually try to avoid the term movement when it comes to Pan-Asianism or Asianism, because for me, Asianism above all represents an intellectual process, a negotiation of a term with tremendous impact, at least potentially. Asianism, I think the study shows, has meant many things to many people, and that's why socialists, liberals, nationalists, chauvinists, imperialists could all use the term for their own political agendas. The reason is that really Asianism, as the term really says, is it doesn't mean much more, initially at least, than an Asia principle, Asiaism. So obviously it could be the Asia principle to unite under Japan's leadership, or of Asian self-determination, of Asia as anti-white or anti-Westernism, or the principle of Asia for the poor and oppressed people. For me, the main point is that during the 1910s and 1920s, this Asianism facilitated a discourse between a large number of people of very different convictions. And as a result, it changed how people thought about Asia. It initiated, in my understanding, a process during which many people started thinking about what Asia is or could be, and in this way they made it their own Asia. Whereas previously Asia had been defined only by Westerners, and usually negatively as something that the West is not or which the West has invented, very similar to how Edward Said in the 1970s defined Orientalism. But Asianism discourse was a reversed process of self-affirmation, although it did contain elements of what Arif Dirlik has called self-orientalization. And this plurality, I think, is reflected in the discourse that I call Asianism discourse.
That's great. Thank you so much. That really helps. Now, in chapter two, you look at the impact and legacy of Takeuchi Yoshimi, who you mentioned earlier, his utopic understanding of Pan-Asianism, and demonstrate how this comes in part through his focus on the Meiji period and skipping the Taisho era, which is the focus of your book. Could you give us a critical appraisal of Takeuchi's ideas and influence on the historiography of Pan-Asianism?
I think for all researchers of Asianism, Takeuchi's impact really is fundamental. I personally, I've never read any engagement with Asianism as critical and also as passionate, which I think is special. He's really passionate about Asianism as Takeuchi is. And that is why, because, well, Takeuchi was not only a scholar of Asianism, but he was also a kind of Asianist himself, who, especially after the war, sought to raise interest in Asia again among his fellow Japanese. He did this both in the wartime and also in the post-war era, but especially in the post-war era, where he feared that his fellow Japanese would become too American or Americanized and would forget about their Asian roots or Asian comrades. But there are also a few things with which I don't fully agree. As you say, he largely skips the Taisho period of the 1910s, 1920s, to demonstrate, if I may generalize a bit, how the good Asianism bits of the Meiji period turned bad or empty and became propaganda for the greater East Asian cultural prosperity sphere in the Showa period. To this end, Takeuchi works a lot with dichotomies and binaries, such as invasion versus solidarity, or divide Asia versus leave Asia. They are very important ways to approach different aspects of Asianism, I do agree. But there's much more to it, I found out during my research. So I was very happy I encountered Takeuchi Yoshimi's writings early on in my research, but I also think it should only be a starting point for research into Asianism and not the conclusion to what Asianism was and is.
Great, thank you. Now, one of the most interesting parts of that chapter was the way you complicate the Kowa Datsuwa binary in the conversation surrounding the Japanese Empire. Could you explain what this binary is for those listeners who are not experts in modern Japanese history and what your argument is?
Yes, of course. Kowa means revive Asia, and it has traditionally been associated also by Takeuchi with the good guys, good Asianism. Those who had sincere interest in China, for example, went there, studied Chinese, and made Chinese friends. Now, Datsuwa means leave Asia, and is usually associated with Fukuzawa Yukichi and others who looked down upon Asians as backwards and uncivilized, but instead promoted learning from the West. So in a nutshell, you'd say that it is a kind of pro-Asianism versus anti-Asianism, or anti-Westernism versus pro-Westernism. But Japan's position within this binary is never really clear, and it also changed or could change depending on political conviction or preference. And it could also, and it did change with time. For me, the biggest problem with this binary is that from my historical perspective, in the time frame that I study, no one ever discusses Datsuwa. So it's a concept that was, of course, used by Fukuzawa in the 1880s, but the significance that is given to Datsuwa is ahistorical. It is not only not historical, but also a stereotype that oversimplifies the different positions on Asia that existed at the time. So, in conclusion, you could say that Datsuwa is not the traditional antithesis of Asianism, and Asianism is not the antithesis of what later became summarized as the Datsuwa or leaving Asia position. I think this is quite complicated, and I write, I think, quite a bit about this in this chapter. But for me, the bottom line really is that the binary or the dichotomy doesn't help as much as other approaches to clarify what Asianism meant for the people who discussed Asianism as Arjia Shoghi at the time.
That's great. If you don't mind me asking, could you expand a little bit on the Fukuzawa Yukichi's Datsua part? You know, how is it ahistorical, if you don't mind me asking, just because I thought that was one of the most interesting parts of this chapter.
It is, of course, it was written in the 1880s and was published, and it may have been read by a few people. Fukuzawa Yukichi, of course, was a well-known intellectual, but in all the writings that I looked at that actually discussed what Asianism is, it never appeared. And other scholarship has identified that his Datsu Adon only became well known and widespread in the 1930s, so a bit later. And actually, the real boom in Datsu was in the post-war period, when Japan turned again towards the West the second time after the Meiji Restoration. This time, just like after the Meiji Restoration, not completely voluntarily. And in this context, it seemed to be a perfect, maybe, prophecy of the failure to engage with Asia, and the preference that, or the way that Japan should have moved, chosen anyway, to look more into the West and follow the Western model rather than dealing with Asia. Because even the aggressive policy, the imperialist policy towards Asia, was by some people seen as not a realization of Fukuzawa's advice to leave Asia, but rather the opposite, to engage with Asia, namely, in a way, even though it was only propaganda, to create a greater East Asia for prosperity, to look for an engagement with Asia that at least on the surface looked like Japan was going to seek unity and solidarity with other Asians. And this was harshly criticized in the post-war period. So Fukuzawa Yukichi became a key point of reference in the post-war period. In the first writings on Asianism by Takeuchi and others in the post-war period, they all deal with Datsu Adon. But during the Taisho period, nobody writes about the Datsu Adon. That's why I think it is ahistorical in that sense.
Excellent. No, that's great. That clarifies the Datsua part that you were talking about. Thank you. Now, in Chapter 3, which is entitled Asia Becomes an Ism, Early Chinese and Japanese Asianism, could you tell us what you mean by Asia becoming an ism in the early Taisho period?
Yes. Asia as a concept, of course, had been around for some time. And by the early 20th century, several concepts that implied Asian commonality had been discussed in public discourse, such as same script, same race, or Asia for the Asians. But this Asia discourse really only gained momentum with the emergence and the spread of the neologism called Asianism. Asia as an ism. It is important because then, as an ism, it could be discussed alongside other influential isms, such as various nationalisms, internationalism, worldism, militarism, liberalism, and westernism. So it had the family of other isms that it could refer to, and in this context, it was discussed, I think, in a way that loose concepts such as same script, same race, and Asia for the Asians could not. And in fact, the first use of the term I found in a local Kyushu newspaper in 1892 exactly appeared in the context of other isms, namely in the context of Japanism, Nihon Shugi, Euro-Americanism, Obei Shugi, and a kind of worldism, Sekai Shugi. But this isn't only, or Asianism here, it appears in 1892, but it only became widely known and widespread around 1912 and 1913 in the context of the racial exclusion legislation in the US, and then, of course, during World War I.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Great, thank you. Now the next chapter explores conversations surrounding Asianism during World War I. Could you tell the listeners about Japanese imperial policies and interests in China during this period? And could you also give us a taste of some of the Asianist arguments in Japan and China during the Great War?
Well, even before World War I, Japan had, of course, expanded its empire above all as a result of the First Sino-Japanese War in 1894-95, after which, for example, Japan acquired Taiwan. Ever since then, Japan had pursued a policy of imperial expansion, and it was during the First World War that Japan took over German possessions in China and in the Pacific. According to Asianism as solidarity, it should have returned those positions to those that the Germans had stolen them from in the first place, for example, to the Chinese. But Japan refused and made every effort to keep those possessions, including in Shandong province in East China, where the city of Qingdao is located. Now, as I said earlier, both Japanese imperialists and anti-imperialists then started to use their own conceptions of Asianism to argue for a Japan-led Asia as empire, or for an Asia for the Asians in a sense of national self-determination. Both sides were often unified in their critique or outright rejection of the West, which was a topic that was particularly en vogue during World War I. Culturalist Asianism then emerged that argued that the West was in decline and the yardstick of so-called Western civilization, which so many Japanese had believed in, had been wrong.
Great, thank you. In Chapter 5, you explore the racialization of the Asianism discourse in the aftermath of the 1919 Racial Equality Bill proposal and the racist immigration policies in the U.S. that you mentioned earlier. Could you tell us about how and why race became a central feature of Asianism discourse in the post-Versailles period?
Race actually had always played some role in Asia discourse, and Asia was often used synonymously with the yellow people, the home of the yellow people. So sometimes it was reduced to racial features. But in 1919, racialist and political Asianism crossed their paths when the Japanese and the Chinese delegations at the Paris Peace Conference together proposed to abandon all racial discrimination and to make this racial equality a principle of the League of Nations. However, the proposal, as is well known, was defeated, and this defeat further fueled the acceptance of Asianist and anti-Western sentiments in Japan in 1919 and the following years. And this was very clearly linked to the rejection of the racial equality proposals. So it became a racialized Asianist discourse already at that time. And even before, actually, namely, as I mentioned earlier, in 1912, 1913, when Asianism became widely spread in Japanese newspapers, at that time, the trigger was that the state of California and later U.S. federal law restricted and later completely forbade Japanese immigration to the U.S. Based on race. So race had, in that sense, played an important role in promoting Asianism in Japan. And actually, the very first use of Asianism that I could identify in a national Japanese newspaper was in 1913, when there was a debate of whether the Japanese should be banned from immigration to the U.S. or some U.S. states, like other Asians, or if the Japanese should maybe be treated differently from other Asians and not be banned because of an assumed higher civilization and level compared to other Asians, even though they were racially Asians. Then when the Japanese were finally included in this total immigration ban by Asians in 1924, this became the peak of public Asianism discourse in Japan, and maybe was that one moment in history in which Asianism was embraced by more people in Japan than ever before.
Great, thank you. Now, in the same chapter, you go in depth into the special edition on Greater Asianism by Nihon Oyobi Nihonjin in October 1924. Could you tell us what you found interesting and significant in this journal? In doing so, could you focus on the figure of Oishi Masami, as I found him to be a fascinating figure, yet someone who has not featured much in the literature thus far?
The special issue that you mentioned is really fascinating because it symbolizes the nature of Asianism discourse, as I call it. It is really a discourse rather than an ideology, because people are constantly negotiating its meaning. And the channel was generally on the side of a sort of Asianism as Japanese expansionism and imperialism. So it was more, to use Takeuchi's binary, it was more on the invasion side than on the solidarity side. But this special issue also printed a number of extremely critical contributions, including some outright dismissals of Asianism as silly, as nonsense, as useless. So it is really quite a remarkable historical document, the diversity, the plurality of opinions, and the engagement of so many people with the concept, who were asked actually by the editors of the journal to respond to the question, what is Asianism for me, for you? What does it mean? And what is the future of Asianism? As for Oishi Masami, he was a progressive Japanese politician interested in Western social science and Western ideas of democracy. He had been active in various political movements to promote democracy and people's rights in Japan from the early Meiji period onwards. But Oishi also liked China, and very early on he had proposed an alliance between Japan and China, and then he went on to propose various alliances, but they always, they had various partners, but always included Japan and China. Oishi wrote the foreword to this special issue that you mentioned, and very directly proposed that Japan must be the leader of a united Asia. And he also proposed the creation of an Asian League of Nations, which was an idea, obviously, in rejection of the Geneva-based League, which stayed around in Asia discourse for quite some time. And it was also one of the aims of the Pan-Asian People's Conferences in 1926 and 1927.
Great, thank you. Now in chapter six, which is entitled The Regionalization of Asia, Asianism from Below and Its Failure, you focus on two Pan-Asian conferences in the 1920s. You argue that they could easily be dismissed as Japanese imperial propaganda, yet, and I quote from you, how then can we account for the controversial debates during the gatherings, the willingness to accept and include dissonances, and the official state efforts at preventing and even closing the conferences? How do we account for the fact that, despite police and government repression, and despite the limited achievements of the first conference, participants from several countries made the effort to convene a second conference, end quote. Could you expand on this, as it seems to be fundamentally challenging how these conferences have been characterized in some of the literature thus far?
Yes, in fact, this was one of the most exciting parts of the research for my book, also because there is very little research actually on the conference, or there was at the time when I did the research. And as you say, some of the literature is pretty critical of the conferences. Most of the literature actually neglects the conferences. And others, the minority, I think, of scholars who have dealt with the conferences are more positive about them. And I would say we still do lack some documents to conclude convincingly on the nature, or kind of a definite answer on the nature of these conferences. But I've been able to look at a number of documents, and I was also influenced by Jamie Lydeen's internationalist interpretation of the conferences, and I do believe he's right. The conferences were civil society-driven gatherings that neither the Japanese nor the Chinese governments welcomed as intelligence from different sources tell us, not least Chinese and Japanese sources. On the contrary, the governments, the Chinese and the Japanese governments, they did everything to stop the gatherings from taking place. And also they tried to stop people from entering Japan to participate. And the conference, the first conference, which was supposed to take place in Tokyo, was moved to Nagasaki. So they wouldn't gain too much attraction from international media. And the second convention actually closed after just a day. So the governments did not like those gatherings. According to the sources I found, the participants, however, they were really seriously interested in promoting Asian commonality through exchange and also compromise. Compromise maybe where governments were not able to compromise. So they tried to negotiate things on the civil society level that governments could not do officially. And in my reading, they are not an expression of oppression or hegemony. Eventually, of course, the conventions failed, and some of the participants later got involved in different less egalitarian Asianist projects. And I think that's why some scholars have dismissed the 26 and 27 conferences in Nagasaki and Shanghai as imperialist or chauvinist. But I don't really think that's right. These two conferences are fundamentally different, let's say, from the 1943 Greater East Asia Conference, which was state-centered, state-sponsored propaganda, and definitely not a voluntary gathering.
Great, thank you. I really found that chapter really fascinating and convincing. Now, the next chapter, you talk about how Pan-Asianism gets appropriated from above by the Japanese Empire, particularly from the 1930s. Something you focus on in this chapter is how Pan-Asianist ideas and speeches of Sun Yat-sen, the famous Chinese nationalist figure, were appropriated by both the Japanese Empire as well as other Chinese nationalists after his death. Could you expand on this aspect and tell the listeners what the significance of this is for your argument?
Yes, the Sun Yat-sen is a very central figure when you talk about Asianism. But the Japanese government had always been suspicious of Sun. After all, he was a revolutionary and he was a charismatic leader who may have threatened the success of Japanese expansionist policies on the mainland. No Japanese official affiliated with him when he visited Japan for a last time in 1924, a year, or actually several months before he died in 1925. During his last stay in Japan, he delivered his famous speech on Greater Asianism, which became iconic, and in which he openly criticized Japan. So it's not really a surprise that Japanese officials or Japanese government did not really like him or his speech in particular, at least at the time when it was given. But then when the war against China broke out and the Japanese government was kind of desperate to promote, as propaganda, of course, Japanese-Chinese friendship, Sun Yat-sen suddenly appeared to be a perfect reference to friendship and cooperation, because he had always been maintained his friendship with his Japanese supporters, and he had been to, in Japan a few times, and he had great contacts in Japan. He's kind of a symbol of this Sino-Japanese friendship, even though Sun Yat-sen's message to Japan was very, very critical when he talked publicly in Japan. But during the wartime, then suddenly Sun's speeches appeared in government, Japanese government promoted journals, and the Japanese foreign ministry even published a Japanese version of Sun Yat-sen's selected writings and speeches, which is quite a thing. A foreign leader and revolutionary gets the honor of being published by the foreign ministry, Japanese foreign ministry. In my view, this shows how much the Japanese government had appropriated Asianism and with regard to China, and as a message to China, but also to the Japanese within Japan, Sun Yat-sen's Asianism in particular. But also in China, since Asianism became a main instrument to gain or to claim legitimacy among the many different factions within and also outside the Kuomintang. Most famously, the reorganized national government under Wang Jingwei in Nanjing, which is usually characterized as a puppet regime, a Japanese puppet regime, is definitely a collaborationist regime. This government derived its legitimacy from claiming to have inherited the leadership from Sun Yat-sen and their collaboration, explicitly their collaboration with Japan was justified as being based on Sun's conception of Asianism and the message, Sun's message of Sino-Japanese friendship. And interestingly, they could use the criticism of Japan that Sun used as the concluding sentence of his famous Great Asianist speech in Kobe in 1924, also to make sure to the Chinese audience that this is not a collaboration in a sense that Wang Jingwei's regime is just blindly following what the Japanese tell him, but it is an independent government. It is a reorganized national government which tries to be good friends with Japan, but is not a puppet. And in this way, referring to Sun Yat-sen, and especially the Great Asian speech, was very handy.
Great, thank you. Yeah, that was a really fascinating part of the chapter. Now, could you read the concluding sentences of your book and tell us what you meant by them? In doing so, could you tell us what you think Asia means in our contemporary politics and discourse?
Yes. Asia as a concept comes with a history. Much of today's historical baggage or historical significance of Asia has been attached to the concept in Asianism discourse during the two decades that have been studied as the main temporal focus of this book. Today's Asia discourse may rightfully be characterized as a constant and continuing renegotiation of, first, remembering its history, and simultaneously of, second, emancipation from its history, in order to deal with the new challenges of the present. These challenges, after all, may not be too different from those of the past. Yes, what do I mean? Well, first, the similar challenges refer to continuing injustice, oppression, hegemony, and exploitation. Times have changed, but also they haven't. This is not a world of equality and fairness. Asia today does much less than maybe previously, just by the concept itself represent poverty and injustice, as many countries in Asia have become rich and prosperous. But at least for many people in Asia, inter-Asian solidarity and the common experience of colonialism, its legacy, is an important aspect of fighting global capitalism, the neoliberal world order, injustices in knowledge production, and so on. So in this context, some Chinese, Taiwanese, Korean scholars have in the early 2000s started to rediscover the writings of Takeuchi Yoshimi and his critique of Western capitalism, and they have used that criticism to re-embrace Asia and Asianism as a concept denoting solidarity, not only limited to Asia, but basically to all like-minded people or everyone who is critical of the injustices or the injustice global problems of unfairness and exploitation and oppression, which are continuing problems, of course, of our time. The problem is that outside of maybe the Asian context, this may not be too problematic, but alienism, of course, as it comes with this baggage, with this historical legacy, with this negative historical legacy, this can only work in the light of this history of Japanese imperialism in Asia, if Asianism, the history baggage is both remembered, it is addressed, it is critically addressed, people show awareness of this, these negative aspects and the negative legacy, but also if emancipation from its history is possible. So if this term remains toxic, then it can't be used, and the negative legacy will forbid any positive use of the concept, and then it would also mean to engage maybe differently with problems that could be identified with the terms Asia or Asianism. But these scholars have used Takeuchi Osemi's attempt to rehabilitate the term and the concept in a way that it allows also Japanese and, of course, especially also previous victim nations of Japanese imperialism to embrace the term, to use it positively, and to use it to critique current problems of global and conditions also in the nation states in Asia and in the region. Now, by constant and continuing renegotiation, I mean that today's Asianism, in the sense that I try to explain right now, makes references to historical Asianism. But its meaning is renegotiated in today's political setting, which is different, of course. So Japanese politicians, for example, today say, we don't need a strong leader in Asia. Asia is important, but we don't need a leader. Which is the exact opposite of what many people said in the 1920s, 1930s, and 40s when Japan was strong, and the role of the leader would naturally fall to Japan. On the other hand, which I also discuss in my book, in my final chapter, in 2006, the current Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, proposed in an essay called Neo-Asianism for the 21st Century, an Asianism that was a very Sino-centric approach to Asia. So Asian is now as a way to claim regional and global leadership for China, not for Japan, reflecting China's new economic and political strength. So today, as back then, Asianist can be essentialist, referring to assumed unique Asian characteristics or an assumed Asian way of doing things, but it can also be very pragmatic in a way that it can become a slogan for claiming leadership that otherwise may be more difficult to claim.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for those concluding thoughts and for reflecting on the importance of Asianism in our present. So I've taken so much of your time, but before I let you leave, could you tell us what you're working on next?
Yes, thank you for giving me the chance to promote my current and ongoing project, which also deals with what is the price with Japanese, Chinese history. It is a project that studies John Rabe's Nanjing Diaries. John Rabe was a German businessman who had lived in China for almost exactly 30 years from 1908 to 1938. When he left Nanjing, and where he lived since 1931. He had witnessed the Japanese attack and invasion of Nanjing in 1937, and famously he had written a diary with daily entries and lots of documents during the particularly crucial period from September 37 to February 38. Rabe is also famous for having organized the international safety zone in Nanjing, in which several thousand Chinese were protected from the Japanese atrocities in the cities. I think think in among researchers, Rabe's diaries are relatively well known, but many don't know that the version that was published in 1997 is not the original version written by Rabe in Nanjing. It is a selection of a digest from a digest version that Rabe wrote in the early 1940s in Berlin, so a rewritten version. I happen to gain access to the full unpublished original version, which is much longer and contains also many documents. So I'm using these sources to compare the original and digest versions, and also compare them with other writings from people who were in Nanjing at the time. I try to understand how Rabe experienced the war and how he reflected on the war and his experiences, including his humanitarian deeds in his diaries. But I also, from a historiographical perspective, I want to understand why he changed some of his entries and what that may tell us about his view of the Japanese, Chinese, of the Nazis, the perpetrators, the victims, and also of his own role and his self-perception.
Great, thank you. That sounds fascinating. Look forward to reading that when it comes out. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for giving me this chance for the interview.